sort of scroll back its activity in the city since the uprising in order not to provoke people more, but it still continually there still continues to be incidents of police brutality even since George Floyd was murdered. And so people don't have confidence in the MPD to be a tool of community safety. It definitely is not, has not regained its legitimacy in the city since the uprising.
Yeah, and also to ask you, Karen, because, you know, I mean, millions of people protested around the world. I think something like 2,000 cities and towns, over 60 countries. I mean, rural areas in the U.S., like Southern Illinois, that formerly areas that were known as sundown towns, you had smallish protests, but nevertheless, they were happening there. Are you feeling now that perhaps a sense of complacency has set in, or people's attention span has gotten a little shorter? You know, because at least thus far, we haven't seen the turnout, at least in the numbers, as has happened after the initial murder. And do you think that people are just kind of waiting and seeing how this is going to unfold with the trial? Your thoughts?
I believe you're right. I think people are waiting to see what will happen and seeing if any kind of justice is delivered through the court system. I mean, I think that is one of the functions of the court system, is to, in the way it plays out in this country, is often to drag things out for a long time and take agency away from people in the streets. But in Minneapolis, the area where George Floyd was murdered, 38th in Chicago, is an area both Mike and I know well. That area is still occupied by people. There are still barricades up in that neighborhood. There are still community meetings happening there twice a day to help run what they call George Floyd Square. And police are still not welcome in that area. And that still exists, you know, how many months, you know, nearly a year after George Floyd was killed. Similarly, there's other militant movements within the city. There are homeless encampments that were sprung up and self-organized by people without homes throughout the city in the wake of the uprising. So very much Minneapolis is still not back to what they call normal since the uprising. But it's true that the mobilizations haven't been the same as they were after George Floyd was killed. And I think we'll have to wait and see what happens.
Yeah, and Mike, just, you know, Portland, I mean, was in the news because of a lot of what happened there, the ongoing protests, the criminalization of a lot of the protesters. And there was some concern that, well, some of the protesters perhaps had their own agenda, and it shifted away accountability for the killing of George Floyd. But just your thoughts now, because Mike, the whole demand of defund the police, that spread seemed like a cane fire across the country, and you did have several cities moving to try to do something about it. The mayor of Portland, it seemed, was a very mixed bag, you know, on that front. So just in terms of demands coming up from the movement and how things are looking now on the ground in Portland itself, of around justice for George Floyd. Mike?
Yeah, there were demands from activists here to defund the police anywhere from $200 million to $50 million. City Council voted on $18 million. I think there was a $15 million cut that was decided on. There was basically a gang violence reduction team focusing on handgun crime that was voted to be reduced because their interactions were disproportionately harmful to the Black community. Now there's a push to refund the police, and we're seeing that nationally. Activists here have, in the years since George Floyd and Breonna Taylor's murders, have started to make a more concerted effort to connect the dots between police terror, police brutality, the way the police treat Black people and get away with murder, and the way that the state treats houseless people. and more marginalized people who are facing abject poverty on the streets of our cities. And a lot of the Black Lives Matter protesters have gone out to try to prevent the sweeps and the raids on encampments of houseless people. Portland has remained consistently active and resistant and in the streets throughout the course of the year, with some short breaks due to extenuating factors. I'm expecting to see more of the same militancy this summer. Portland has also been a stage for some time now, and more intensely recently, a stage for the clashes between the extreme right and forces of Black Lives Matter, those who support the movement for Black lives and anti-racist and anti-fascist. So I'm expecting to see more of those conflicts and clashes throughout the summer, because unfortunately, I do believe that the conditions we face as a society are going to be ones that manifest more police terror, more police murder of innocent people, of unarmed people, of Black people, people of color.
Right. And Karen, it's just final thoughts from you. You know, looking forward, we know all eyes are on the trial. You also talked about other kinds of organizing going on in Minneapolis around houseless people, etc. But tell us how you see things moving forward. And also, you're a union guy. And you know, I noted a poll, a Pew poll that was done. I read an article this morning, I think it was reported in the Washington Post, that actually said that after January 6th, you know, the invasion of the Capitol, of people basically trying to, you know, stop the counting of the vote, a lot of violence there, deaths did happen, that among the Republican Party, actually people have remained steady, it seemed, in their support for Trump. I mean, it's gone down a bit. He's no longer in the White House, but clearly he is still there and maintaining a presence and a hold, it seems, on the Republican Party. And I'm wondering how you see that playing out where you are, and just, you know, any final comments that you might have, Karen Knutson.
Thank you. I think that in terms of the first part about the unions, I think that the unions just have not done what's needed to be done around George Floyd and so many other issues. I think that the unions tend to trail behind some politicians, and that's exactly backwards. Instead of doing that, the union should have been out in the street with the protesters, should have been opening up our union halls to give aid and support to the protests, should have been pushing the issue in the different workplaces where we have presence. And I think actually if the unions had been doing that in a consistent way and really arguing that an injury to one is an injury to all, it would actually, to deal with your second question, help undercut some of that support for Trump that still does exist amongst specifically white working class people, because that support for Trump is clearly against the interests of regular working class people, but it persists basically based around, you know, racist identification with the white power system. And I think that the unions could be playing a very positive role in undercutting that, and unfortunately I feel like the unions are still way far behind what they need to be doing.
Yeah, a lot of work to be done there. And Mike Crenshaw, just your final thoughts and comment on this, because the defense in their opening statement seemed to blame the bystanders, the onlookers who were there, for what happened, right? Which is just amazing that that is part of, you know, him saying that Chauvin is innocent. Your thoughts on that and any final words you have for us?
Let's continue to hold police accountable and question the necessity for overfunded police departments in our communities, and examine whether they're actually a threat to our safety or an asset, whether they're actually a liability to our communities or an asset. And let's continue to organize for autonomous ways of defending our communities and supporting each other through mutual aid, so that we do not have to rely on the police as we have.
Right. Well, on that note, we're going to continue to follow this. So I really hope, Karen and Mike, that you will join us again as this trial continues. We're going to be following it very closely. Thank both of you for your work. Thank you for joining us, and y'all, please stay safe. Thank you.
Thank you, Margaret.
All righty. We're going to take a short station break. And coming up, the people's attorney, Nana Jumphy, she's going to weigh in on all of this. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping now. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping now. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Look how I'm living now. Police be tripping now. Yeah, this is America. Guns in my area.
My area.
I got the strap. I gotta carry 'em. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go into this. Yeah, yeah, this is gorilla. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go get the bag. Yeah, yeah, or I'ma get the pad.
If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook and our handle on Instagram and Twitter at So True Radio. And we are worldwide and nationwide on SoundCloud. Today, we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And internationally, we'd like to give a shout out to our listeners in the UK, where they are up against a policing bill. There are protests that are and riots. It's actually that broke out in Bristol, England, around some of these same issues of policing. We are doing in-depth look at what is happening now as the trial of the man, the police officer, Derek Chauvin, who killed 46-year-old George Floyd on May 25th, 2020. And here, setting up, we're going to be hearing from a woman known as the people's attorney, Nana Jumphy, and to just set that up and to get her comments, let us go to some of the key moments from the defense's opening statement. Keep in mind, this is the defense now who is being backed by police organizations with something like a dozen lawyers and $1 million. Let's hear what the defense had to say.
I want to talk about reason and common sense and how that applies to the evidence that you're about to see during the course of this trial. Reason is an idea that wholly permeates our law, our legal system, and it forms the foundation. And you will see and hear that repeatedly throughout the course of this trial. What would a reasonable police officer do? What is a reasonable use of force? Common sense tells us that we need to examine the totality of the circumstances to determine the meaning of evidence and how it can be applied to the questions of reasonableness of actions and reactions. It is nothing more than that. There is no political or social cause in this courtroom. And you will see and hear everything that these officers and Mr. Floyd say to each other. You will see that three Minneapolis police officers could not overcome the strength of Mr. Floyd. Mr. Chauvin stands 5'9", 140 pounds. Mr. Floyd is 6'3", weighs 223 pounds. Mr. Floyd does end up on the street and appeared to continue to struggle to these officers, so much so that they considered applying what's called the maximal restraint technique. It used to be called the hobble or the hog tie. Mr. Chauvin used his knee to pin Mr. Floyd's left shoulder blade and back to the ground, and his right knee to pin Mr. Floyd's left arm to the ground. You will see and hear that a crowd begins to develop, watching and recording officers, initially fairly passive. As the situation went on, the crowd began to grow angry. And remember, there's more to the scene than just the office, what the officers see in front of them. There are people behind them. There are people across the street. There are cars stopping, people yelling. There is a growing crowd and what officers perceive to be a threat.
Well, let's welcome Nana Jumphy back to Sojourner Truth, attorney, consultant, educator, activist. She is the president of the National Conference of Black Lawyers. She's also the executive director of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, known as BAJI. Attorney Jumphy, she is known as the people's attorney by the communities she serves. Nana Jumphy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so very much for having me, Margaret.
Well, Nan, I know you're following this, and actually in that clip, I mean, you heard the attorney representing Chauvin calling it a hog tie. You know, he really didn't have to make that reference, but he did. I think that said quite a lot. And then again, the whole thing about the fear of the black body. You know, Floyd is 6'3", 223 pounds. And after all, this poor little white police officer, he was only 5'9 and 140 pounds. Anyway, Nana, your reaction to what you just heard from the defense.
So this is, you know, typical. It reminded me when I was hearing it of a police report that we had from a case here in Los Angeles when they had the celebration of the National Days in honor of Mike Brown in 2014. I'm sure, Margaret, you remember how there were folks who blocked the freeway, like the 10 freeway right there where the 101 is here in Los Angeles. And there were seven people, and one of them was a brother, tall brother, much in the George Floyd vein, except he had locks on his head, so you know he was super scary to them. And in the police report describing what happened, where it says weapons involved, they put physical presence, right? Throughout the report, they describe him as calm, as quiet, and yet they still put, this is LAPD, that his physical presence was a weapon. Mm. And I think that says it all, right? Black people are considered to be weapons just in their blackness. And so had George Floyd been 4'8", they still would have talked about his physical self, his physical stature, as being a reason for us to believe that he was, you know, super strong, the savage who's able to throw police officers off of him with a single bound, right? And I think that it's important that we continue to lift up all of the ways in which this case, in which police violence speaks to the efforts by folks in this country to continue to deny the humanity of black people. You know, we don't feel pain. We can't be subdued without extreme violence. We must be feared. All of that is just a repetition of, you know, the what they've put out here about our folks and have used against us in the context of state violence and state-sponsored violence from the beginning.
Yeah, and going back to Thomas Jefferson, the so-named founding father, who himself was a slave owner and a rapist of a 14-year-old Sally Hemings that he had children with. But he was going on about how black people, we just don't feel pain. And also we don't grieve the way white people grieved. Meanwhile, they're snatching, you know, children that you've given birth to and, you know, sending them off. So that, you know, and even today, if you look at the disparity in health care among black people and the fact that if we're in pain, you go to the doctor and you're in pain, they just don't believe you. Or, you know, with George Floyd saying, I can't breathe, and the response being, well, you know, you sure have enough breath to be saying what you're saying. You know what I mean? It's that really continuum that you're talking about, Nana.
Absolutely. It's that continuum. And so we shouldn't be surprised. And we know, I mean, this is not the first case. It's not the second. It's not the tenth. We already know. Before the defense counsel for Chauvin testified or spoke, did his arguments, we already know what he's going to say. We already know. They've set some of this up ahead of time in terms of, you know, discussing what could be, you know, why is it that George Floyd could suddenly be some superhuman person that needs to, or really subhuman person, that needs to be subdued. We've already gotten all of the prompts, not just from what we've seen happen in these cases, but from all these propaganda shows, right, that are permeate our TV screens, that talk about all the things that reasonable officers need to do and how reasonable officers are in these situations. It's all been set up, Margaret. It's all been teed up. And so it really takes an intentional effort, and it's going to take an intentional effort on the part of jurors to separate what we've been taught, to separate what we've been programmed, to separate what they're being told by the defense from what they actually see, what they actually hear, what they actually know about what happened to our brother George Floyd.
Yeah, and I mean, also the treatment of, I mean, you know, I always go back to the shootings that happened in the church of 9 black people being killed, and then the police officer taking the young man responsible for, you know, to Burger King or something, you know, to get him something to eat because he was hungry. And now this white guy who killed 8 people, including 6 Asian women outside Atlanta, now they're saying, well, you know, he's just mentally ill, and, you know, he had a bad day, and, you know, he had these sexual hang-ups, you know, et cetera. So there's always that kind of excuse given. Meanwhile, with George Floyd, basically he was accused of using a counterfeit $20 bill, and for that cost him his life. Eric Garner, accused of allegedly selling loose cigarettes, and that also cost him his life. So that kind of double standard, I imagine, is part of what people are looking at to see, is justice possible for black people in the United States? And I wondered if you wanted to comment on all that as well.
So I'm an abolitionist. What that means is that I don't want there to be police, I don't want there to be jails, and I don't want there to be prisons. I don't want that for me, for you, for our kids, or for Chauvin. I don't want that for anybody, because it's like the death penalty. As long as one person gets killed under the death penalty, we know that it's disproportionately going to affect our people, and that other people are going to be killed. And in the same way, for me and for those of us who are abolitionists, we can't say that we want to dismantle a system and then call on the system to step up. I think that what those double standards clearly demonstrate is that, in fact, the police state is not what's going to keep black people safe. And it is a state that cannot be reformed. We're not going to reform the police. We're not going to, you know, train them differently. Again, Margaret, you and I have been in this a long time. Some of what people are talking about now, including what's in the Justice and Policing Act, are things that from 30 years ago, from Christopher Commission, from community policing, that we already see are not going to work. They don't happen. And yet we kind of still expect that to happen, that someday cops are going to look up and treat our people humanely. That's not what they're designed to do. They are designed to treat black people as if they were escaped enslaved Africans, and they're going to continue to do that. And so there is no justice, no, that's going to be found in this system. And, you know, we need to be clear that this system needs to be dismantled, that we need to find a completely other way. That's another show. But with respect to, you know, this case, as we're looking at this case, let's understand that justice is not going to be achieved, even if there's a verdict and Chauvin gets the maximum time that he could get at the highest charge possible. That will still not be justice. It will not change anything about policing. It will not change anything about the safety that black people feel and must feel with respect to policing. It will be an individual situation that will have no systemic and institutional effect.
Right. So what you're talking about, Nana Jumphy, our attorney here, the people's attorney, Nana Jumphy, is a complete systemic change. And on the meanwhile, we know that George Floyd's family, there are many black people across the United States and around the world that are looking and are saying, well, justice itself is on trial in the United States. And is it possible, you're saying that within this system that we are under, this capitalist system that we're under, it's not really possible and that we have to look for alternative ways, and that you're right, that is a totally other show. But what about the demands about defunding the police? There's a lot of misunderstanding about what that means. That was a demand in Minneapolis, and in fact, the Minneapolis City Council members had promised to dismantle the city's police department and create a public safety system. Now, that hasn't happened, and there was backtracking, you know, on that. But you have seen cities like Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, Seattle, Milwaukee, Philly, and others, about a dozen cities that have initially reduced police spending. And then you mentioned H.R. 7120, the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act that was introduced by Congresswoman Karen Bass in June of 2020. It passed the House. You know, we'll see what happens with it in the Senate. But meanwhile, there are these interim measures of people really trying to do something to try to save the lives of black people. Thoughts on this, Nana?
And there are many efforts. Some of them are efforts, I think, that are moving us in the direction of abolition, such as the efforts that have made up in Oakland, where they were able, Cat Brooks and the Anti-Police Terror Project and another project that they're working with nurses and other medical folks there, have been able to get the city of Oakland to agree to enter a contract with community groups and community organization to take cases or to take calls that are dealing with, for example, mental health breakdowns. And so that is actually moving something away from the police. It's not police-like. It's not diet police. It is totally community-ran. And so we do see that. I think that these other efforts, or there are many other efforts, including the Justice in Policing Act, some of the efforts to defund in LA and other places that really are more reform oriented, meaning that at the end of the day, they serve to try to create a legitimized police force, like a sanitized police force, a kinder and gentler police force. And so obviously for those of us that want no police force, that's not the direction we're trying to go in. We're trying to go into a dismantling space. I think with respect to the defund in particular, the moving of funds away from the police really has, you know, doesn't have a lot of effect unless it also includes the moving of funds in ways that defang the police. In other words, take away these weapons, you know, demilitarize, and in ways that dismantle, actually dismantling projects and programs. People would be surprised how many programs that are supported by their city, their county, their state, have police pieces in them that become part of the law enforcement budget. And so until we actually begin to defang the police, to remove the police from these spaces in the process of dismantling as well as defunding, we're still going to find ourselves in spaces in which the police are alive and well, continuing to do what they were created to do.
Yeah, and just quickly, we're almost out of time there, but a couple of things on the international front. It's been reported of a Salvadoran woman, a migrant, who was killed in Mexico by Mexican police in a similar way of George Floyd, you know, the knee on the neck. And meanwhile, in the UK, there are protests today. There have been about people against a police bill of increasing the powers against the police. So it does seem that what happens here in the United States and the kind of widespread protests that happened as a result of George Floyd has had a ripple effect in bringing out what is happening to some of our brown sisters and brothers in the United States, but also outside of the United States and other parts of the world. Just your final thoughts here, Nana.
So I would say that if we look in those places, Mexico, if we look at Britain, if we look at Brazil and other places, people have always been on the ground fighting, right? And so, you know, with respect to the police, there have been rebellions in England, as you know. There have been, you know, just talks of this, what's happening with the police in Mexico and Central America, South America, the continent of Africa, and SARS, right? All of that. So I don't think it's new. I think that there is often an attempt by the United States to make itself the standard, and that many folks follow the U.S. in terms of making the standard. But I think that, you know, the push of revolution, the push of the people on the ground against the tyranny of the police is not a U.S.-rooted thing. It's not something that you just see here, but something that we're seeing all over the world. And I think people are just making more connections as we have the technology and other pieces to make that happen.
Right, and we saw that in the uprisings in Nigeria as well. Well, we're out of time, but Nana, I do promise we will come back and focus on abolition and what it means, and hope to have you back and Ruthie Gilmore and other people who are part of that abolitionist movement, because there's a lot of misunderstanding and questions on that. But we appreciate you. Thank you for your work. Thank you for joining us, Nana Jumphy.
Thank you.
All righty, we are out of time. Today's show produced by me, that's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the assistant producer, Romero Funes, our audio engineer, Gary Baca. If you'd like a copy of today's show, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. I want to thank all of our guests and thank you for listening. And y'all, please, stay safe.
This is Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7.
Did you miss the Life During Wartime Marathon? Shame. No problemo! You can go to kboo.fm/